Thank you for being here today. I'm going to whiz through my 150 slides a little quickly, so apologies in advance for leaving you a little blind, but I'm going to do what I can to cover everything in a somewhat intelligible manner. Thanks, Shelley. I want to start, you can see my disclosures. I want to start off by saying that it's important to, important to have some water, to recall that there are policies that set and drive our agenda and shape it. And these are policies that have been different at times in the past and which we can influence. In an earlier era, activism and progressive policy have improved public health and social justice. Looking, for example, at income growth in an earlier era between 1947 and 1973, income growth was distributed roughly equally. The poorest 20% of families saw income growth at least as fast as the richest 20%. We have experienced and still experience in the U.S. Policies that we sometimes think of being applied only internationally and refer to as structural adjustment. We've heard them described as a neoliberal agenda as well. Attacks on regulation, privatization of public services, including health care, slashing taxes and social programs, constraints on public interest organizations. And I'd suggest we hear the opposite often, but I would suggest that corporate control of economic policy has actually stifled innovation, productivity, and wealth. And in the current economic downturn, it's a particularly timely moment to consider that possibility. Looking at income inequality has exploded with the imposition of these policies between 1979 and 2005. In the bottom fifth of households, I'm going to have to say this faster, there's been only a $200 gain for the bottom fifth of households and about $6 million for the top 0.1%. And this is just an example. I'm going to skip this one, and I've told you about that. You know that we're having an economic downturn. This just looks at the extreme growth of unemployment by race recently and the crash in the housing bubble. So what did trade agreements do? And I want to suggest that trade policy is one area where we can influence and change these trends. They're supposed to facilitate global corporate transactions. They can be an important engine of economic growth, can restrain the natural tendency to monopoly, but the way present agreements are written, they actually lock in advantages for certain producers and countries. They challenge access to affordable medicines and water, national tobacco control medicines. A human rights framework would better hold governments accountable for protecting and advancing the rights of populations. And these are just a few examples. One of the things that trade agreements do is give both in some cases corporations and in other cases other countries the right to demand financial compensation if the terms of the trade agreements are not met. And it makes them very powerful in terms of enforcement. So I'm again going to skip over these particular examples. You can read about this particular NAFTA challenge to a health and safe to the attempt of a state in Mexico to protect their health and safety. Just a statement from PAHO that and the World Health Organization that open global trade is a major force in increasing tobacco consumption. Similarly, with the alcohol industry, trade agreements tend to reduce regulations and make it easier for alcohol products to be traded and consumed without regard to safety. These are the kinds of laws and regulations that are at risk. We've heard about health and safety, a little bit about food safety and medicines. We don't often realize that things like clinician licensing, public administration of water and sanitation also can be constrained and affected by trade agreements. So what should we do about this? What have we been doing about this? The Center for Policy Analysis on Trade and Health, and again, I encourage you to look at our website, www.cpath.org, has worked in collaboration with the organizations and speakers that you've heard, and certainly the APHA Trade and Health Forum, and a number of other organizations to call attention to the health threats from these trade agreements, and have issued statements calling for the assurance that health takes priority over trade and over these trade rules, to assess the impact of trade agreements on health, to exclude basic public health functions, environmental and workplace protections from regulation by trade rules, and to include our voices in our voices as public health in trade policy and trade negotiations, and in fact proactively to improve access to health care, water, affordable medications, and environmental safety. I'm going to hope that you know what the World Trade Agreement Organization is, and just mention that because WTO agreements have been difficult to conclude and to negotiate, the U.S. has recently turned to regional and bilateral agreements and has concluded agreements in this decade with Australia and Central America. We are looking at, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the process of approving these agreements. There are pending agreements now with South Korea, Colombia, and Panama, and new negotiations called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And we'll skip that one. So, democracy and trade policy. How are these trade agreements set, and who makes these decisions? Basically, the administration, whoever's in the executive office, negotiates trade agreements. There's a U.S. trade representative. Congress has to approve or disapprove whatever is negotiated in the trade agreements. During most of the Clinton administration and just about all of the Bush administration, there were fast-track rules that limited Congress's ability to change these trade agreements once they were negotiated. Basically, Congress could only vote yes or no. There is no such fast-track limitation in place right now. But that is one of the reasons why the trade advisory committees, which we're going to talk about, play such an important role. The trade advisory committees are a mechanism for domestic input into trade negotiations. They provide formal and informal advice to the executive branch. They were created, federal trade agreements in general were created in 1974 to balance the influence of corporations in federal policy. And the law requires a fair balance of interest on these committees. This is what they look like in 2005 when we started looking at the advisory committees. These were big businesses related to health, the pharmaceutical industry, tobacco, alcohol, food processing, and health insurance had ample representation on these advisory committees. Public health had zero. Members find them very effective, I will just say. They get access to confidential information, provide written opinions to Congress prior to votes, and have access to policymakers. There are three tiers of these committees, and again, I can tell you more about those later, but one is sort of general policymaking. I'll tell you about them now, and appointed by the president. Tier two is cross-cutting interests. Tier three is where individual sectors get together and actually provide basically instructions to the U.S. Trade Representative about what to negotiate for. Since 2005, again, CPATH and many of you and public health organizations have both been asking for, advocating for, suing the government for better representation on these committees. We had one tobacco control rep appointed in 2005, additional representatives in 2007, and made a presentation in the new administration, which I will say has had a more open set of discussions about these issues, presented these issues to the new trade representative in 2009. There is a bill pending in Congress for the next couple of weeks, H.R. 2293, and David Wallingham mentioned this, which would actually create a cross-cutting Tier 2 public health committee so that we could both have access to confidential information and talk to each other about these issues. There has been some progress. Just about a month ago, President Obama did appoint somebody to the Tier 1 committee, to the ACPIN, who has a background in global health, and she's been invited to talk to our Trade and Health Forum. We had a hearing on the bill about a year, the bill to create a Tier 2 committee and include more public health voices in 2009. The chairs of the Tier 3 committees recently spoke out and asserted that adding any additional representatives to their committees would ruin the system of trade and commerce in the United States, essentially would grind to a halt. They insisted that they have provided, that they are the only legitimate voice, that they alone drive the economy in a positive direction, and we would please go away and leave them alone, except that they like the idea of creating a cross-cutting Tier 2 committee for public health and NGOs in general because it would keep them away from them. So, thank you. So we are have drafted a statement and collaborating with our colleagues in the labor movement and with our sponsors in Congress. I should say there's a bill both in the House of Representatives and in the Senate responding to this kind offer from the chairs of the ITACs, saying that we agree that a Tier 2 committee would be a good idea, but that we must recall their attention to the legal right and responsibility to appoint representatives from labor and civil society in general to Tier 3 committees. We suggest that it's important that we take up a new program starting this year for economic development and for trade advisory committees and for trade in general. We have a set of principles, these you've seen, and I've talked to you about the advocacy opportunities, specifically our public health objectives, and I hope that we will share the implementation of these as we work together to get seats on advisory committees, our assuring democratic participation by public health and transparency in trade policy, to develop mutually beneficial relationships that create sustainable development, recognize the right of public health to regulate, exclude tariff and non-tariff provisions that address vital human services, similarly exclude tobacco and tobacco products and alcohol products, and assure that our rules around medicines don't make them unaffordable and assure access. More broadly, I think an agenda for economic and social justice is to demand policies that create a healthy economy, that we insist on public investment to re-stimulate productivity and demand, recognize that jobs to lower-income people do create demand, and that investments in healthcare, education, energy, and the environment are productive. Look for fair financing. We've seen a lot about tax breaks, that we want to reinforce the tax breaks to wealthy individuals do not create jobs, but do and should be reversed so that we can afford the services we need. That it's the government's role to support baseline survival, advance social justice and well-being, that they should guarantee the rule of law and financial regulation, and finally, empower organizations of civil society, including increasing other public health voices on trade policy, trade advisory committees. This is where you can find us. We hope you'll join the listserv, and again, it will be a great project for the next couple of weeks. We hope that all of the chairs in APHA of sections, caucuses, SPIGs, forums will sign on to the letter, and if you're part of other organizations that would like to engage in that, I'd love to hear from you. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Ellen. Thanks to all our presenters. I'd love to invite our presenters back up and open up for discussion and questions. And I'll just say, once again, if you haven't signed up our sign-in sheet to join us in the Trade and Health Forum, please find one circulating around. Thank you. Yes.
I'd like to address a question to all of the panelists, and it pertains to the fact that corporate PR or propaganda, for example, in the United States, is about 1/6 or 1/7 of our total economy. This has changed drastically this year with the Supreme Court decision in January on Citizens United. What do you think? We've already seen the impact of Citizens United in the election just last week. What do you think is going to happen with global trade under Citizens United?
Well, in my opinion, it's going to exacerbate the problems that we saw in this election. in 2012. I expect us to see a range of figures in, I think this election it was about $4 billion, and it's probably going to go, you know, geometrically up. And that's going to give, and certainly more ensure that the transnational corporations, at least in the U.S., are solidifying the influence that they have already in who's elected, whether they have pro-public health positions or counter to public health positions, and just ensure their access through lobbying. So anything that, like Ellen has been talking about, will be more easily fought, I think, by the corporations through their influence in the legislation, for example, and the USTR probably too.
Others? Oh, yes.
First of all, thank you all. It was brilliant. This goes towards Mr. Garrett Brown and also the panel in general. You mentioned El Salvador, the export processing zones or the free, you know, trade zones. Those tend to be, from my reading and understanding, like a ground zero of worker exploitation. And I don't know if I've ever read about any protections offered to workers in those zones. That's kind of counterintuitive in a way, but do you know of any protections for those workers? And if not, do you know maybe what, you know, what type of agreements would be appropriate to make offer protection?
Well, the simple thing is that there are a number of EPZs around the world where literally trade laws, national trade laws, are suspended, simply suspended by law. So it'd be relatively simple to say, well, you can't do that anymore, that national laws protecting workers' health and safety should be enforced in all workplaces that exist on national territory. But there has to be a political will for that, and that's what I was talking about Mexico and China previously, is that if you're a developing country that has tremendous need for foreign investment for either economic development or payment of foreign debts, which is not only Mexico's problem but many countries, you're totally behind the eight ball when it comes to negotiating with huge transnational corporations. The other thing that's very important is that even if they do have national laws, most of these countries have very limited financial, human, and technical resources to actually enforce them. And in fact, like in our own country, there will never be enough government inspectors to actually enforce health and safety regulations in any workplace in the world. And what's key is that you have active, empowered, informed workers that have the right to report to government agencies where they are, to negotiate with their employers directly in the case of unions or workers' councils or whatever. The only way we're going to get to safe and healthy workforces, workplaces around the world, is when the people who are there all the time that have a direct interest in safe workplaces, which is the workers, have the ability and the capacity and the confidence that they can improve those workplaces. So I think that any trade agreements that we sign ought to recognize the reality that government agencies in and of themselves cannot assure that or guarantee that, and set about a policy on a global basis that workers have to have the right to refuse unsafe work, the right to know what exposures they have in the workplace, and the right to organize themselves to defend their rights.
Yes. Thank you. Yes, Maggie had to catch a flight, so she apologized for leaving early. There are others who would comment in.
Well, let me just say what I can about that. Maggie would obviously a better comment. Sure. The question was that the person, I think you felt that you were harmed by a counterfeit medicine. Did I understand that correctly? And you... It was contaminated, right, right. So what do we do about drug quality, I think, basically? And I think you're referring to the act. You can't hear me. So what do we do about drug quality? And I think Maggie was making some favorable comments about the treaty on counterfeit drugs, which is doesn't totally address the situation you're talking about. I think it's sort of that looks more at, as far as I understand, other people here may know better, just labeling and manufacturing and certification. I think that's been a very controversial treaty, similar to the other ones that we have seen. There may be a real problem there, but it is being used and exploited by the brand name pharmaceutical industry to discriminate against generic drugs. And I think it's taking, there is insufficient civil society input and attention to the input of civil society into the details of that agreement, and making sure that we don't use a real situation that is really problematic to disadvantage policies and manufacturers that would make medicines more affordable and accessible. So that's my thought on that. I just want to say one thing about the current environment and what may go on, and I'm not sure how Citizens United will affect trade negotiations. Obviously, we think that it's having some effect on our elections. I do want to remind us all that trade agreements are extremely controversial, and that even in a Congress where the major party has changed, it's not assured that it's going to be an easy fight, for example, to ratify Colombia agreements with Colombia and South Korea, and it's certainly going to be extremely important to find advocates for fair trade in Congress, which is extremely possible, and assure that there's a vigorous debate about those agreements if they're brought forward again. I want to also say I think that the administration is making a greater effort to involve civil society, although they've been very slow about appointing people to these trade agreements, to reach out and actually see about the prospects of putting in a labor provision in new trade agreements. As you've heard from Garrett and others, of enforcing those provisions is going to be certainly another question, but there's been a recognition that the policies that we have probably aren't going to successfully move forward just as they have been to date.
Yes.
Congratulations on this session and on the chapter of the AAPA. Very impressive.
Thank you.
I come from South America, from Brazil. I want to ask anyone on the panel some advice. Well, Brazil, as you know, has now elected a second left-leaning president, and Latin America generally, A, has become stronger, and B, is now less likely to be invaded by the USA than it was, say, 20 years ago. Brazil is an interesting case. Brazil is a creditor. But you won't ask on it. My question is, what is your advice to the governments and to civil society organizations, specifically in those countries in Latin and South America whose economy and culture has not yet been situated? Oh, and by the way, the other thing is that you're reading this, which is great. Please include all the works of Chalmers Johnson, starting on this book, Rover. You'll understand why.
Well, I think, there is the famous pink tide of governments in Latin America that are left of center and are more pro-worker, pro-environment, pro-women than they were under previous governments. But I think the advice, well, for one thing, it's probably not our business to give advice to people on how they want to reorganize their own countries or how best to achieve that. But I think to do that anyhow is that the... what civil society and organizations in Brazil or anywhere else need to do is what we need to do in the United States, which is to organize on a grassroots level among organizations that are actually affected by adverse policies. One of the great crying shames, I think, of the Lula government in Brazil is that they're pushing ahead with dam construction in the Amazon, which will destroy a large amount of environmental have tremendously adverse environmental effects there and destroy the culture and the history of many of the indigenous groups. And that's a Labor Party PT government position that's been moving ahead under the new administration as well as the old. So I think to change things in Latin America or to change things in the United States, it's a question of organizing among those of us that are adversely affected by those and then demanding that the governments put the interests of the vast majority of people ahead of the interests of a tiny minority of transnational corporations who have, unfortunately, tremendous economic and political power.
We have time for a few more questions. Let's take one over here. Thank you.
We have one, and that is there are a number of
one which, in my opinion, is the most urgent, and that is to look at the websites of those organizations that are trying to do something about the corporate funding of elections through these independent expenditure organizations. We've got to cut out the corporate funding of elections in this country. That's, I think, in my opinion, that's the most important thing we're going to have to do.
Get your organizations to sign the letter to the USTR insisting on public health representation on trade advisory committees, and it would be interesting perhaps if this organization officially, in addition to its chairs, if APHA as a whole would sign such a letter.
Well, you know, not just APHA, but health professionals are probably the biggest growing group in the economy, despite the poor state of the economy. And I think we've underexerted our political clout, particularly around changes to the food system. We've launched something called Healthy Food Action to try to take advantage of the ability of modern media to create these virtual communities that have a little more influence than any one organization does. So I invite you to check out Healthy Food Action and sign up to become part of that community to advocate for fair and healthy food system policies, including trade policies.
I'll be very brief. I've had a couple shots at this already, but the thing that's been most revealing to me over the last 10 years is on doing this work is how much foreign debt is actually a public health and an occupational safety and health issue. That until countries like Mexico or other countries in Latin America or countries in Africa or Asia are relieved of this unbelievable foreign debt for which they have no money available for domestic development and cannot afford to do anything which would antagonize foreign investors, all public health and particularly workplace health and safety is not going to be advancing. So even though it's really weird to think about foreign debt as a public health or occupational safety and health issue, I think it is. And that's something I think all of us need to sort of think about, study a little bit ourselves, talk to our friends and families and coworkers. And really, there are a number of organizations out in the world. Jubilee 2000 was one that started 10 years ago. There's other issues, other organizations that are out there now dealing with foreign debt, because until we deal with these debts, which were not taken by the people, which didn't benefit the people, but are being paid for literally out of the blood, sweat, and tears of the people in those countries, we won't be able to go forward.
Thank you. Well, what a great note to end this session on in terms of thinking of where we take this information toward next steps. Thank you all for your attention, for attending this session. I know our panelists would be glad to speak with you if you'd like to come up. I do have cards for Maggie since she wasn't able to join us for the Q&A section. And again, I invite you to join our activities with the APHA Trade and Health Forum. Thank you very much to our panelists, and thank you all for being here at this close to final session. Thank you.